This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai whakaronga mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Sally Round. Today we check in on flooded South Auckland growers and head over to Gisborne, where farmers have been knee-high in forestry slash from their floods. We meet a couple who jumped headfirst into growing lilies and travel to Marlborough, where grapevines and mountain bikes have replaced stock on a high country station. But first to our look at conditions on the land this week, which is dominated by the aftermath of the torrential rain and storms which have been swirling around the top of the North Island. Leah Tebbett's here to tell us how growers have been faring. And you were out and about in South Auckland this week, Leah. What did you find?
Rain was falling hard as I drove up. The area had had roughly 300 millimetres of rain since Friday. Paddocks, fields and stock are sodden. Heavy rain had been expected Tuesday, with more sandbags brought in preparation. Thankfully, the rain was not as heavy as predicted, so most growers didn't suffer further. However, signs of Friday's flooding were still very much evident. Surface flooding, silt piles and onions littered the rural roads. Some fields in low-lying areas were still deep underwater, and others, once neatly tilled, are barren after being washed out by floodwaters.
And the deluge came at a really bad time for the onion harvest, didn't it?
Yes, one grower I talked to on Pollock Road sits at the bottom of a rise. Their main depot is on site and houses onions, fertiliser and all their grading equipment. As the water fell on Friday, it flowed down Pollock Road, turning into a torrent, wiping out the fields and streaming through this depot. The water was a metre high at least, and as I walked through the building, you could still see the brown water line indicating just how high and how much water came through. There were roughly, I think, 600 bins of onions stacked four high, stored in the depot at the time. Those on the bottom filled with water, leaving the onions inside soaked. There is hope they will dry out, but that depends on the weather over these next few days.
And that's the fan noise, Leah, is it, that we can hear drying things out?
Yes, it's working to dry out the motors of the grading machinery in the depot. At this stage, it's not looking promising. So it's not simply the crops affected, but all parts of the business. Prav Hari leads the growing operation and showed me around. However, he couldn't talk. He was mentally exhausted and couldn't find words to describe the anguish he had faced in recent days.
Yes, we've got a feel for those growers, haven't we, Leah? Tell us a little bit more about what you found.
Well, water was still flowing at pace down the culvert just outside the depot site. I spoke to a grower of leafy greens. On higher land, he still predicts to have lost 10% of their crop. It's the same for this onion and potato grower who is asked not to be named.
We harvested Thursday night, harvested onions till reasonably late, and then woke up Friday morning and it was just sort of constant rain. And as the day progressed, it got heavier and heavier.
So they were harvested like sitting on the paddock, like,
yeah,
drying out?
So we're actually lifting them off. These have been out a couple of weeks. These would have been harvested now had the rain have not come.
Gotcha.
So they're right ready for harvest, and everything around this area is the same.
And you just do onions?
Onions and potatoes. We're just waiting and seeing how they're all sitting in the ground, so if the water drops away they'll be okay, but if it stays up or we get more rain they will start rotting in the ground.
And Leah, what did you find further north of Pukekohe?
Slips become more and more evident as you drive further north, but I eventually made it to the Waiuku area and the home of weatherman Brian Hamilton, who leases land to a farmer in the valley below.
So we're on the Fitu Peninsula, which is on the southern south head of the Manukau Harbour, right across on the Auckland Airport.
On Saturday morning, was this just completely flooded and it's looked that way since?
Yeah, so yeah, our valley here was underwater, but then it drained away, and then we only had another 20 millimetres on Sunday and it flooded again. So that's... Once the ground was wet, it just floods, the water just runs off. So another 90 mils, and that's actually the biggest lake I've seen here in the Owl Valley. So it's just horrendous how much... We don't want any more rain, but luckily I think that's the worst of it. Yeah, the farm at the end of the road there, they've never seen that much water. Yeah, so, but it does drain away quick here. We're quite lucky. We just need the rain to stop now, as everyone does.
He hasn't lost any stock or anything?
No, I think luckily, you know, it was predicted, so it would have kept the stock off. Grass can actually handle being underwater for a week or two. It's pretty resilient, and it actually adds a lot of nutrients back. As long as that water can drain away within a few days, the grass doesn't mind.
I also visited Pleasant Valley Blueberries. Owner Sade Dodd was planning to open the orchard, as she does every Auckland anniversary, to her pick-your-own customers. However, rain poured through the orchard in a stream up to your calf, a sight that returned on Wednesday morning. There is no damage to the orchard itself, however low-lying fruits have been affected and the ripe fruit is now falling off as it's past its harvest time.
And Leah, the Bay of Plenty didn't escape from this weather either.
Yes, Te Puke farmer Rick Powdrill says he recorded 530 millimetres of rain for January, about half of that falling in just 2 days at the end of the month. He says other farmers only a matter of kilometres away recorded 300 millimetres in a 24-hour period during the Friday deluge. Local Federated Farmers President Brent Mountfort says all parts of Bay of Plenty have been affected. He says on farm, culverts have blown out and access roads have slips covering them.
Also access for milk tankers, forestry, it's actually quite a... And then when you get on farm, actually getting stock trucks in and out can become a bit of a challenge. And as farmers, you know, we're dealing with all these sort of extremes all the time, but this time round it's been quite extreme. There's a farm up Lower Kaimai's there, and at the moment they actually have to drive out their front gate and go further up the Kaimai's and come back in the back end because they can't actually access the back of their farm at the moment.
It's also delaying just some basic on-farm work, isn't it? Like shearing, like silage making.
Most farmers haven't been able to do that. So the contractors are hopelessly far behind now. The same with shearing. Usually it's done and dusted before Christmas. On the plus side, the grass is growing in the hills. It's an issue down on the plains, though. It's too wet. Dairy farmers are way down on their milk production, and some are even using supplements already.
Brent Mountfort says some maize crops have had huge bare patches because it's been too waterlogged and there will be supplementary feed shortages in coming months. Some kiwifruit vines and the structures they grow on have been wiped out following the extreme conditions in Bay of Plenty and other kiwifruit growing regions of Northland and Tairawhiti. The head of the grower group, NZKGI, Colin Bond, says damage isn't widespread, but for a few individual growers, it's been significant.
And Leah, from one extreme to the other, parts of the South Island are preparing for a drought.
Yes, the West Coast and Southland are both experiencing low soil moisture. Rain and cooler temperatures are forecast, with farmers hoping it brings some reprieve. However, heads of industry were meeting on Friday to discuss the dry climate and make sure they could stay on top of it as best they can.
Thanks, Leah. And some good news, we've heard the harvest in Canterbury's in full swing. Recent hot weather has brought crops ready, and with good weather at the moment, contractors are doing huge hours.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
We're heading to the Tairawhiti Gisborne area now. Farmers there are looking forward to having more boots on the ground in coming weeks to help clean up their farms still littered with forestry debris from recent storms. Now let's join RNZ rural reporter Maya Burry, who's with Regional Federated Farmers President Toby Williams on his 1,500-hectare sheep and beef farm.
Our family's been on this farm for about 130 years. We've been in the region for about 150. With the La Nina weather system we've had over the last 3 years, we've tended to get quite a lot of big, heavy storms come through and isolated thunderstorms that have hit specifically north of Gisborne. Also south of Gisborne in March last year, we had a big storm that tickled up the entire region and northern Wairoa as well. Heavy rainfall is not uncommon. We've got up and behind us is Te Aruru Areas and Rokuma Ranges, which are used to big rainfalls. But it's been tough for farming. You know, we've had multiple floods. Some of my neighbours have had four floods in the last year where the fences have been taken out, floodgates, things like that, and it starts to grate on you after a while.
Yeah, can you talk about sort of the scale of some of the damage you've seen, especially with this latest flood with ex-cyclone hail?
Yeah, the latest one, if you say it doesn't seem to get any worse, but it seems to be worse. The areas that have been hit harder than the other storms. So March last year was a big storm called widespread damage, lots of slips and things like that. With this one, we've got record-breaking river levels. They've really come up high. Our own river came up across the road, through the bridge, which it did back in 2018 as well, in the Tolaga Bay floods. And it's just taken out fences, and we've got logging debris scattered through flat paddocks again now, which is really heartbreaking for farmers, because you can't put your re-fence, you can't do anything to that logging debris picked up.
Has that debris been picked up yet? Or, I mean, we're nearly, a month on from the flooding. How are things going with the recovery?
It's just, it's slow. It's been so wet. You know, I'm in my gumboots for the second month in a row when we should be in our work boots and a pair of shorts. It's really wet. You need heavy machinery to do this. Heavy machinery needs dry ground, otherwise you just make more of a mess. So the clean-up's underway. Farmers are doing what they can. You know, it'll be months and months and months, if not years, for some of this country to be fixed up, and or if it's ever fixed.
Can you just talk to me about a bit more of the practicalities of what you actually do when you're trying to clear woody slash from your farm? Where does it all go? What do you do with it?
There's a couple of things you can do. The first thing, you need to pick it up. If it's on your flat, on the riverbank, you need to pick it up and take it somewhere else. You can't leave it there because that's someone else's downstream's problem the next time it floods. So you need to get it higher than what the flood levels are, which sometimes is easier said than done. So you really need to be trucking it and then stacking it somewhere higher. And if you're lucky and it dries out, you can burn it. You can chip it, but it's, there's a massive cost involved in that. And still, you've got to put it somewhere. It's good for your garden and things like that. I think that the beaches have been chipping quite a lot and utilising it on community gardens and things like that, which is a great use for it, but it'd be nice if it wasn't there. And I said, to be fair, the government wants to go into the bioeconomy, and we had a meeting with Minister Nash yesterday, and they said, well, why aren't we accelerating this program? Why aren't we looking at, when we're harvesting our trees, utilising the whole tree? We're not leaving anything in there to wash down. We're chipping it, and we've got microplants doing, whether we're making wood pellets or we're converting coal-fired boilers and things like that. Everybody wants everybody to get rid of that. We can be using this wood we've already growing. And Tairawhiti, in our region, we've got a lot of it. We should be leading the front with this.
You talked about the big cost of sort of removing that slash. Who pays for that?
That's a really good question. In some cases, you may be able to get some insurance. Forestry companies will do some. They seem, depending on how bad it is, they'll clear the main infrastructure. And in the past, it seems to have they've got bored of doing it. And they've gone back to doing their regular job, harvesting trees, back to their day jobs. So often the cost falls back on individual farmers, and it's a cost you don't really want to keep bearing again and again and again. So the forestry companies do pick up some of the slack for it, and that's their equipment that comes in. We'd like to see them in and doing it. There's tens of thousands of tons of woody debris and damage, and thousands of hectares damaged from this. So the cleanup is going to be really long-winded.
Can you talk a bit about Enhanced Task Force Green and how that works and what support that will be providing?
Yeah, so Enhanced Task Force Green is run by the Ministry of Social Development, and effectively what you have is people who are work-ready, work-fit. They come in and they get guaranteed a certain amount of work. I think they're looking at this stage, it's 4 to 6 months worth of work for them. And what the guys do is really, if you've got stuff tangled up in your fences, they're pulling all that stuff out. They're cleaning out wall sheds and any flooded buildings. It could be a person, someone's house, it could be a marae, it could be a community hall or a farmer's house. They'll clean the silt and debris, get all that stuff cleaned and cleared out. And with this lot we've got going now, they're putting fences with them, so then these guys can start repairing fences as they go. So it's not just left up to the farm, then clear the straight off, then put it back. So they're doing a whole job at once, and hopefully get these guys trained up. And a few of these guys may transfer from being on the social welfare dependent to actually working and working on farms and things, which would be great. Priority is those guys that have lost roadside fences and boundaries. Let's get them repaired. Let's get them so their farms are stock-proof so they can move forward. We're coming to a critical time of the year for sheep, and it's a mating season, so you want to be able to have a farm that's stock-proof. And we don't want livestock on the roads and things like that either. So,
And could you just talk a bit about maybe the disruption to farmers' operations that is sort of occurring because of the damage?
The biggest probably effect has been on our roading network and the actual ability to get livestock in and out. The council's working, pretty hard at trying to repair that, but it still hasn't stopped raining. The roading contractors need dry weather to repair roads. So that's the biggest ongoing thing, is trying to get our roading network back up so we can get people to town. Kids are just coming back to school now. We need to make sure they're safe and happy going. It's not, a two-hour journey into your local school where it used to be an hour. Those are the big things that really affect farmers at the moment.
Do you worry about the morale of some of the farmers who have been impacted by this?
100%. The mental wellness side of things we're really, really concerned about. There's only so much you can do when you've lost your fence for the fourth time in 12 months. You know, you've spent $30,000 putting your crops in and refencing only for it to be gone again. One of my good friends, a neighbour up the road here, I tried to call him straight after the floods, wouldn't even pick up his phone. I talked to his wife and he said, oh no, look, he's not in a good space. You know, it's just, you know, he's a guy who you wouldn't expect to be like that. But it drags you down. And the lack of sunshine as well, you know, sunshine, the big, you know, vitamin D and big yellow up there, we haven't seen it. You know, they had a few days over Christmas and, like I said, I've been in my work boots once in January. Normally it's hot and sunny, you're worried about putting sunscreen on. I couldn't tell you the last time I had to put sunscreen on the farm. So the mental side of things, it's going to be long. We're going into winter, we're so wet now, we're really concerned that any storm now causes more damage, causes more disruption. And there's continuing cost pressures on farms. And for some farmers, it's going to be too much for them. So we need to make sure we've got the safety net right at the top of that cliff. People and we're talking with the communities. We've got community events going to happen over the next month or so, making sure people are okay, making sure people are well, making sure they know the support there. You know, the Ministry of Social Development and the Rural Support Trust are there. We've got people you can talk to. There's the government's been great in terms of having to spread your income if you've had severe damage and things like that. So support's there, but we need to make sure people grab hold of it.
Toby Williams, a farmer and Federated Farmers Rep for the Gisborne region, speaking there to Maya Burry. And Maya tells us the Task Force Green Workers will be on the ground in a couple of weeks. Colin and Mary Birch are no doubt some of the few people who bought a business in the middle of 2020. Travel along a small country lane outside Cambridge and you'll find them, along with multiple greenhouses full of lilies. The couple own Lilies by Bluedon, and as Leah found out, jumping headfirst into a business you know nothing about brings its challenges, pandemic aside.
Oh my goodness.
This is what a day looks like.
No, you have to be kidding.
This is a day.
That we're standing in a sort of fridging unit.
It's about 300 square metres.
Full to the brim with two tiers of lilies. How many lilies?
Each one of those tubs would have about 50 bunches. Each bunch has got five, and there's 250 lilies. I don't know how. I mean, there's probably 30 or 40,000 lilies in here.
You can't smell them as wildly as they thought you might, probably because of the chiller, right?
Well, it's the chiller, and our job is to sell them as closed and as tight as possible so that the recipient gets the benefit of them. The fastest it can be is picked today, out tomorrow to an auction, and then to a florist. So it's a day or two to get to there, and then it's being used. This is all going out the door over the next couple of days, so we'll have new stuff coming in for the markets. They will have been picked on Friday to the market on Saturday, and then they will probably take 3 or 4 days to open, and then they'll last for a couple of weeks before they then start dying. As a satisfying thing, for the price of two cups of coffee, people will have a bunch of flowers that are developing and changing for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, for literally $10.
Right, we'll go up into the greenhouses.
Everything's still open. Good job. Thanks, Tony. I will go.
So this is what the smallest lily house looks like. So this was the original lily house. These are all planted and ready for Christmas and the first few weeks after Christmas. They're probably about 8 weeks old.
Really?
At the moment.
Wow. So it doesn't take them long to grow then, does it?
No. And there's about 2,000 stems per row. So this bay here is probably about 8,000 stems by multiple bays. So not quite 500,000 in the various bays, but that's kind of the quantum that's going through all the time.
How do you organise the different bays? Are they done by colours, done by variety?
They're done by variety and their length of grow. Mm-hmm. So everything that's in the bay will grow at the same pace. They might be different colours. We're unique in that we want to be able to provide some of every colour and every type at all times. So we predominantly do Oriental, which are the large scented lilies, and Asiatic, which are the slightly smaller but getting larger unscented lilies. And then we do much smaller volumes of rose lilies, which are double lilies, and Christmas lilies, sort of longiflorum type. So those are much smaller volumes. So basically, we'll be planting a bay about 5,000 stems a day is probably what we're looking for. So probably about this every day.
But planting that every day?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, and picking it and grading it and putting it through the chiller and selling it.
So how many people do you have to do all of that work?
Between 10 permanent full-time and a few permanent part-time and a few odds and sods. Should we go back inside?
Yeah. We might have to run away from this rain.
Hello, I'm Mary Birch, and I currently run Lilies by Bluden, which is a lily nursery in Cambridge.
And I'm Colin Birch, and I help Mary in running the business, mainly on the infrastructure and equipment side of things.
Colin has been buying me lilies from here for years and years. We've lived in Cambridge 14 years now, and he's always bought me lilies from here, and they've been a favourite for us. But we were really looking for a sort of change of direction, I suppose. Since I've been in New Zealand, I've worked in local government. But then there comes a point then actually you realise that you want to do something different and something else with your life. And we came across this opportunity through mutual friends that we discovered that the business was going to be sold.
And you jumped at it, or you thought about it for a little bit?
No, we jumped at it. We went and saw them the next day after we'd heard about it. And as I've been buying lilies from the company for years, we knew the owners. And so it was a really mutual agreement that we wanted to take it over. They were really happy that it was going to go from their hands. They created it nearly 30 years ago out of an asparagus field.
Oh, wow.
And they grew it. And they could see that we had the passion to be able to take it on, obviously change things as we want to bring things in, but keep the essence of what we did, you know. Absolute first class lilies in New Zealand to the customers.
Mm. And did either of you have any experience in horticulture? Is that what you'd call flower growing?
Floriculture is the most technical term. I tell you what, the first year was I was on a vertical curve, learning curve, whilst getting to grips with all aspects of it.
When this opportunity came up to take over the business, what time period was that?
We met the previous owners to talk about this probably mid-2020. So first lockdowns had occurred. We were the smug country that was really back to normal after that initial lockdown period. And then we took it over in beginning of November 2020. And then we've had this massive roller coaster of COVID and lockdowns and massive amounts of traditional business disappearing. So it has been challenging, but equally it has been challenging, so that's good. I would guess, and we have some detail, you know, that the mix and the way things are sold now to different groups of customers is completely different to where it was in the old normal, and we don't have a new normal yet.
I think we're really looking forward, aren't we, to just being able to see where we're going to go and how it's going to develop. I mean, in the last month, exports have gone right back up. I mean, still a small percentage, but they were pretty much non-existent because there weren't the flights in and out of New Zealand. You know, at the moment, we're supplying a lot of Pacific Islands and lots of cruise ships around the Pacific Islands.
Really?
Yeah, so it's really funny seeing these orders. I was packing a few today, you know, these orders going off, and you know that there are going to be these gorgeous big lily displays floating around.
Floating around in the ocean. Yeah. Yeah, oh, that is quite a lovely image.
Yeah.
Because we bought it in COVID, we went in eyes open. We didn't perhaps know, like anybody back in the middle of 2020, how long it would last. But equally, we knew what the impact of COVID was on the business. And after that first lockdown, and we were the unfortunate company that had to literally
let the lilies grow and then rotary hoe them back into the ground because there was no market. We couldn't get them anywhere. You know, we weren't ambitious about growth targets, for example, or trying to achieve things that weren't achievable with quality, quantity and current market that was available. And we've done really well with that, and now the growth is coming.
The rain stopped for us slightly.
This is what I was talking about. This is one of those archaic oil burners. So this oil burner here is an Italian monster. It burns about 40 kilos of oil an hour.
Wow.
Okay, and we've got three of those. So we're burning about 120 litres or kilos of waste oil an hour for 10 hours. That's 1,400 litres.
That's a cost, though, for you too.
It's a monster cost. Yeah. Monster cost, but it's hideous. And so all of that, I've taken it out. I've already taken down the ducting.
How exciting is that for you?
It's a massive commitment, but the benefit we're going to get out of it is going to be immense, in that the quality of the heat in the greenhouses will be transformative. Mm. The quality of the delivery of the heat, transformative. The change of waste oil, burning a ton and a half of waste oil a night, transformative. Yeah, we have to pay electricity, but there's a plan around that. We won't do it now, but we will eventually get to generate a few hundred kilowatts of energy through solar.
Yeah,
that will help offset.
Yeah.
So we're just going into one of our bigger greenhouses. What you hear are the fans that are basically just distributing the air around. It's always a combination of humidity, wet bulb and dry bulb, temperatures, light, wind direction. We have a computer system that basically alters everything on the variables based on what's happening now. What is the light? What is the wind direction? What is the humidity? What's the weather? What is it raining?
That's very smart.
It's very smart. And so vents will open and close, fans will come on and off, and all we're trying to do is bring those variables from extreme to moderate.
Yeah.
We can never control them, but if we can influence them, we can. We buy test tubes of aphidious wasps that are about flea-sized.
Really?
So, and what these wasps do is they live in our hanging baskets because they're flowering.
Yeah.
And they then lay their eggs in aphids.
Oh, all right.
And so then the eggs develop and then they hatch, and that kills the aphid. So we don't need to do any spraying for aphids because our wasps...
You've got a natural solution.
It's got a natural solution.
How big is the property that you're working on?
10 acres. And there's just over 3 acres currently under greenhouse. We've got a bit of farm yard where there's some cattle on. There's another field that's about the right size to take a 5,000 square metre greenhouse, which will be our fifth greenhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll look at that investment probably in a couple of years once we've taken the benefit of the increased growth with the heating.
And I'm guessing there's still a vase of flowers in your home somewhere every week.
The odd one.
Yeah, the odd 15. We have got vases that it's lovely. I mean, we're still at the stage where it feels like a crime to throw something out if it can't be sold, if it's not good enough quality to go out. You know, it's maybe it's gone to a market and it's come back and it's a bit beaten up. We're not going to sell it to somebody else, but we can't bring ourselves to put it in the bin. So it goes home.
Colin Birch. And also you heard from his wife, Mary. You can find photos of the couple and their blooms on our webpage.
Kia ora, my name's Quinn Morgan. I'm the Ahu Whenua, a Young Māori Farmer of the Year for 2021. And you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Now to Te Waipounamu, just north of Kaikoura, in the beautiful Clarence Valley. Rick King is a second-generation farmer there at Middle Hill Station. But some big changes on the property mean he no longer goes mustering on the steep hills with his dogs. Cosmo Kentish Barnes has been finding out why.
We've put a vineyard in, and which has taken about 2 years, and Genevieve, my daughter, and her partner have put a bike park in, and they're running what animals are left, what deer are left. Sheep have gone, cattle have gone.
No more sheep?
No more sheep, sadly, because I liked my sheep, but they had to go because there's no room left.
Tell me about the farm. How long have you been here, and yeah, when did you first start farming?
We've been here since 1964, when my father bought it. And Julia, my wife, and I took over in 1985, and we've been farming sheep, beef and deer up until 2 years ago.
Mm. And how big is the station?
It's now only 520 hectares. It was 3,200 hectares, and we went through tenure review and retired all the back country, or most of the back country. But it wasn't an easy farm to farm, so... Yeah, this is a whole new way of farming for me.
Why did you decide to stop traditional farming? Because that would have been a big decision.
It was a huge decision, but it was probably an economical decision after tenure review, when we had less land to run livestock on, and we had to think about diversifying into something that was going to provide for three families. So, yeah, we've had to diversify and intensify.
So will your son and Genevieve, your daughter, live on the property as well with their families?
No, Will doesn't. Will builds boats in Christchurch, and he is involved with the vineyard, and Genevieve wasn't really interested in the grapes. She was more interested in the rugged side of the property. And so they've done other things with that, as you know.
Was part of this change linked to farm succession?
Yes, yeah. Well, 15 years ago I looked at doing grapes, and we actually signed a deal with a company from Florida who were interested in buying it and putting grapes in. And then the GFC came along and it all fell through.
What's the GFC?
The global financial crisis. And then we re-looked at it again just before the earthquake, really. And then the earthquake put it all on hold, and then away we went again. Yeah.
And so has it been a challenging process, farm succession?
Yes. Yes, it was. It wasn't easy. We had to subdivide to make the whole thing work so that the grapes are in one block. And Joe and I have got our own little block left, and Genevieve and Morgs have got their block, and we've still got a hill country block out here, which we're hoping to do carbon credits on, and maybe a trophy block or whatever.
And the vineyards in front of us, how much land do they take up on the flats?
The whole vineyard is 93 hectares, and that's the area. And there's 60 hectares, or just under 60 hectares of canopy of actual grapes. So,
and it's all literally just gone in?
Yeah.
A year ago?
Since September last year. Well, we started pulling deer fences out, and my brother started contouring and tidying the place up, building this dam about 2 years ago. So we're looking at the Pinot block, which is only 4.5 hectares. It's the only Pinot on the vineyard, and the rest of it is Sauv Blanc. And, yeah, the first plants went in last September, and then the posts, and then the wires, and, yeah, it's been a busy couple of years.
Did you put some crops in before the grapes went in?
Yes, we did. We cropped all the flats with barley and peas, just to try and clean things up a bit, and harvested that last March.
It must have been such a process, putting in 60 hectares of grapes.
Yeah, well, it's all credit to my brother, David, who's developed vineyards around Blenheim and in the Arbitrary.
Okay, so he's got a lot of experience in that area.
He's got all that, yeah. Well, he put his hand up. I thought he was retiring, but I said, would you like to develop one more? So he's been here doing, flat out doing that for the last 2 years.
And I guess this land here would have been your prime grazing land.
Yeah, and we used to finish all the deer on these flats, and we've irrigated all these flats where the grapes are. And now we've had to redo all the irrigation for the grapes, obviously, because it's a whole different system.
And the Clarence, the mighty Clarence River, flows along the edge of the vineyard?
Yes, it does, yep.
Is there any risk of flooding?
There's always a risk living beside an angry river, and that's another thing. We've spent just months removing huge rocks out of the vineyard, and we've utilised those rocks for flood protection along the Clarence.
Has it cost heaps of money to put these grapes in?
Huge, yep. But not as much as it would have if we had left it another year.
Because of COVID?
Yes, well, luckily my brother got onto it really quickly when we decided to go ahead with the vineyard and ordered all the material. So we had the material sitting on hand for a year. If we had left it another year, it might have been marginal to have done it.
Mm. Have you funded this all yourselves, or have you got partners in?
No, we've got some partners in with us. We didn't have to. We could have done it ourselves and borrowed a lot more, but I didn't want to take the risk at my age, all the risk. I've been doing that all my life, so we decided to take some investors in as well.
When do you expect to harvest your first grapes?
We talked about harvesting 2023, but we've decided not to now, and we're going to wait till 24 because of trying to grow the plants out, trying to get them better established. It's like growing hoggets out, I suppose. We're just giving them a better chance.
Yeah, that will pay off in the long run.
Yeah, we might suffer with no income for a couple of years, but it'll pay off.
And are you going to bottle the wine and have your own brand, or will you on-sell the grapes?
The grapes will be on-sold. We're basically just cropping farmers for Indervin and Villa Maria, who we've got a contract with.
Jump to get this. Now we are heading down to the lower blocks of grapevines. And right now we are sitting on a fault line that came up 12 metres after the earthquake.
Yes, it's one of the biggest land upheavals ever recorded, uplifts. So we ended up having to put about 20 big groins in here to stop the currents taking away any more good land. It took 4 hectares out after the earthquake, which we didn't really need happening.
That's a lot of land.
Had enough damage as it was.
Because the epicentre of the earthquake was on your farm, really, wasn't it?
Yes, near it. Well, the Papatea Fault goes right through us. It just follows the limestone right to the sea. You're looking at it right there. But the positive side of it, Cosmo, is the geologists tell us that it only ruptures once every 5,000 years, so I feel reasonably safe. Yeah.
What have been the biggest challenges you've faced putting in a huge vineyard here?
In some of these free-draining riverbed areas, the rocks have been major, and huge rocks, sort of 4 or 5 ton rocks. We spent weeks here with tractors and grabs and, just getting rid of the rocks. And then we put a rock crusher through these stony blocks down here, and that turned it into dirt, turned rocks into dirt. As you can see, this was all covered in rocks out here.
Well, I guess the hard work is done, and now it's just a matter of watching and waiting.
It is, yeah, waiting for an income. Start paying some of it back.
So this is one big change on the farm, and the other one is what your daughter Genevieve is doing on the hill blocks with her mountain bike park.
Yeah, well, that's a whole new operation as well. Something I didn't believe would happen, but it has, and it's fantastic.
Back at the yard, Genevieve is waiting to take me up to the mountain bike park. And although it's her main focus, she still enjoys a bit of traditional farming.
I really like the deer. I like working with them. And when we drive just to the top of the saddle here, we'll look down on what's left of the deer farm, what hasn't been converted into grapes. So we've got just about 100 hinds there. And it's cool that the deer farm started in the 70s with my dad and my grandfather capturing them out the back and teaching themselves how to farm deer. So that was Dad's kind of diversifying, and now we're building a bike park.
So as part of the farm succession, your brother's more involved with the vineyard, whereas you have decided to branch out and develop this adventure park.
Yeah, it all was sort of a dream. Oh, it must have been around, even before the earthquake actually, I bought my first bike. I used to travel to snowboard, that was sort of how I spent my 20s, and got a bit sick of being so transient, so I tried to switch to mountain biking. Didn't have anywhere to ride here, so I started building a trail with no idea what I was doing along this ridge behind us here.
Okay.
So I had this beautiful trail along the flat ridge, and then you'd get to the end where it's really steep and there was no trail anymore. You just had to carry the bike down. And then I met my partner Morgan, who is a trail builder and a talented one at that, and he had a dream of turning his dad's farm into a bike park. So the rest is history, really. We've teamed up and built a bike park. Mm. It actually happened. This wacko dream everybody thought I was, you know, just yet dreaming, but it's here.
It's open and it's being used.
Yeah, it's going well.
And when I last saw you about 6 years ago, you were feeding workers who were repairing the highway.
Yeah, that was a totally different.
You had a food truck.
Yep, I had a food truck. I think cooking for 30 road workers for a year and a half was enough of a taste into the hospitality world for me. Food truck's gone. But I was so lucky. It was such a great opportunity.
They were doing the post-earthquake repairs, weren't they?
Getting State Highway 1 reopened. So they would come up from Christchurch each at the end of the weekend and fly from Kaikoura over the slips to Clarence. And, yeah, they were there for the week. And I fed them, with my friend Geordie. So that was just an opportunity I never saw coming, really.
Did that help fund the early stages of the bike park?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, you're looking at our digger right there. That was probably the first major purchase. Mm. Morgan and I bought a digger together. And after that catering contract, we were able to sort of live pretty cheaply here for a year and not do much other work and just really sink our teeth into building a bike park. And it's definitely a labour of love. You wouldn't add up the hours we've spent building trails and expect to be paid off yet.
Well, let's head up there now and hopefully we'll come across Morgan and some bikers.
Hello. Shall we just meet you at the saddle?
I'm waiting for the guys to come down.
Oh, okay. I'll just whip over. We'll see you there.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, cool.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. Are you just waiting for some bikers?
Yeah, I dropped them off at the top and they're on their way down now. Usually you hear them hooting and hollering.
Yeah.
Something like that. Just like that, actually.
Have you always had a love for mountain biking or downhill biking?
Only the last, I'd say, 12 years, I think. Mm. 12 years ago, when I first got on a mountain bike. Yeah, and it was a downhill bike. And I was hooked instantly.
Why?
I'd ridden a lot of dirt bikes, like motocross bikes and farm bikes and that. And then this, I don't know, this lightweight bike with big forks on it. You could run into anything.
Yeah. In fact, there's...
And there's some
one
now.
Of them just turning up now at great
speed.
Oh,
they've come down there. Flying down. There's a big jump there.
So people bike down and you take them up?
Basically, yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's not just for the experienced adrenaline seekers. It's also quite a treat if you're used to mountain biking, you know, self-powered, pedaling yourself around. Mm. It's quite a treat to just focus on the downhill aspect for a day. So Nick and Ash here, they both work for us.
And where are you guys from?
Kaikoura.
Yeah.
Own a shop in town, Coastal Sports. Yeah.
How nice to have this on your doorstep.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I moved here 20 years ago. When these guys opened up, it just completed Kaikoura.
Yeah, yeah. Because there was nothing like this up until now.
No, nothing at all. Yeah. No, it's phenomenal to have this here. You know, just like I said, completes the picture. You got your surfing, your diving, hunting, now biking. It's just outdoor dream.
Do you have to have a sophisticated bike to come
you
down
want
here?
A good quality bike, yeah. Like, good brakes, good suspension goes a long way. But you can still rattle your way down on something pretty basic.
When you were a child, what did these hills look like?
Well, I remember this face below us here being quite clear. Well, really clear. And the face behind us, actually, that was clear. So that actually was clear more recently. Dad was still running merinos up there. So, yeah, it comes back. The bush comes back really quick, especially the tawhini we're standing in front of. Dad always, you know, called it scrub. But when we were trail building, we found when you cut down one tawhini bush, there's just a whole host of baby kanuka, manuka underneath. So giant nurseries, and they come up really quick. Yeah.
Some of the kanuka trees are 4 or 5 metres high already.
Oh, easy, yeah. Yeah, some of them are monsters. That's amazing, really, considering that this face was clear when I was little.
Is your plan just to let it grow and grow?
Yeah, yep, we're already going down the path to register it for carbon credits. So we won't be running sheep, that's for sure. I've seen how much hard work's involved in that. We like the hard work of trail building and then enjoying that. You know, well done to Dad, but it's your passion has to be there to do that. Yes. And then we definitely won't want cattle up here because they would just ruin the trails.
How many kilometres of track have you got, and how tough was it cutting the tracks and making them bikeable?
Yeah, we're probably getting up towards 20 kilometres. It's a whole network, so there's a range of different trails, different grades.
Yeah.
Some of them were hand-built, so just with grubbers and a chainsaw. Others we've used digger on. The funnest part for me was that process before we had a business to run, before I had a baby to feed, you know, just being out here in the bush, figuring out where it was all going to go. And then it was just Morgs and I was on the chainsaw clearing ahead of him, and he was on the digger. And yeah, it's really addictive, you know. You go out with some snacks and a little bit of water, and you come back hours later just so thirsty, you know. You think you're going to be home so much earlier, but you go, oh, just to the next corner, just to the next. But yeah, it's rewarding work.
Now you're daughter is, what, 8 months old?
Yeah.
How has that changed your life in terms of farming and, you know, running this new business?
It's a real challenge, obviously. I knew it was going to be a real challenge, but I guess you just don't fully understand that when an idea popped into my head, I would just go for it. You know, if it was something out on the hill or even something where I needed to work in the office, I could just get a whole lot done. Well, getting a whole lot done looks a bit different now. So learning how to have staff and manage them and try and offload some work onto them. So Nick and Ashley have been a really great addition to the team. But yeah, I'm looking forward to Sienna being that little bit bigger so she can come toddling out with us, and this will be part of her life growing up, just like it was for me growing up, tagging along with Dad.
Genevieve King talking to Cosmo Kentish Barnes at the Middle Hill Mountain Bike Park in the Clarence Valley, just north of Kaikoura. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Ka kite.